Hello, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. We are reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere by Deborah Marquardt. It was published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. We rejoin the story at the point where Deborah is describing Chicken Butchering Day, which involves all the women in her household. As the youngest girl, I stand on the edge of this slaughter, guarding the three loads of laundry my mother has risen early to wash, the whites now flapping on the line. My mother is quick with the knife. Her blade is sharp. She places the chicken on the ground, pulls its wings back, and severs the neck with one quick motion. Without turning to look up, she throws the bird into the air, as if to separate herself from the act. Then she grabs another live chicken. My grandmother kneels beside her, moving more slowly. She cuts off the head, then holds her hand around the chicken's neck, tilting it like a wine bottle she means to pour down to nothing. Under her knee, the chicken bumps and claws until all the electrical impulses that drive its muscles are finished. Beside her is a large red pool running down the hill. And so, it seems, there are at least two ways to butcher a chicken. The water is already boiling in tubs up the hill in the barn where we go to pluck the feathers. Sitting in a circle, we grasp the upturned claws and dip the chickens in steaming water. The feathers come off in clumps and drop into a tub between us. The smell is complex. Water meets wool, meets vinegar, meets dirt. Like wet fur. Like bad feet. We pluck the strong wing feathers with their deep roots and peel away the body's blanket of feathers. Then we rub the skin for the downy layer and pick away the tiny pin feathers nestling inside the deep pockets of skin. Across the yard, Mother is in the milk house with the burning candle. She is the firewoman, singeing the plucked bodies as she passes them over the flame. The room smells of sulfur, the deep caked odor of burnt hair and flesh. Grandmother sits beside her, on a stool in front of the sink. She is the last one to receive the bodies, cutting them in a way that only she knows. Grandmother places the bird on its back before her. She opens the bird's legs, looking for the soft spot, unprotected by bone. "The behinder," she says, "the pooper, the last part to go over the fence." She repeats these words all day, again and again, to keep us from fainting. She draws a sharp blade across the film of skin between the legs. A world of steaming darkness spills out into which she must thrust her hand, extracting the long weave of intestines, the soft gray lungs, the heart, the gizzard, the tiny green row of developing egg yolks, the brown gizzard all swimming in a gelatinous ooze. Carefully, she finds the small sack of bile, the green-black poison that, if ruptured, will ruin the meat of the bird, and she cuts it away. Only she knows how to distinguish the edible from the throwaway parts. She crops the feet from the body with a hard crunch of her knife and trims away the claws, the dirt still packed tight under the nails from the chicken's constant scratching for food. We recoil when she places the trimmed yellow feet on the edible pile. She'll take them home in a bag to Grandfather at the end of the day, and we have no idea what they do with them. And when she holds the gizzard in her palm, like a warm bun, and draws the blade along the edge, turning the sack inside out, to show us the chicken's last supper, I expect to see bottle caps, shiny pennies, diamond rings inside. But I find only an undigested clump of oats, a few tiny bits of gravel. At the end of the day, we tuck in the wings and legs, slipping the naked birds into the dozens of water-filled milk cartons my mother has been saving all year for freezing the meat. She sets aside 4 of the biggest birds for frying that night. Girls, she says, just think. Fresh chicken. Ugh, I say to grandmother as we walk the red wheelbarrow to the dump ground to bury the parts, the metallic tinge of blood still in my mouth. Do I really have to eat it? I ask. I could use a few days for amnesia to set in, but grandmother tells me I must. I must learn to know the taste of what my hands have done on my tongue. I did a tough apprenticeship in storytelling with my family, sitting around the supper table where we 7 ate our meals together. On Sundays, or holidays, our grandparents would join us and our numbers would blossom to 10 or 12. The platters of roast beef, mashed potatoes, fried chicken, and dumplings would go around, tipping precariously as they were passed from hand to hand. The food was always less important than the talk, and the thread of the story always held firm over any interruptions. Eventually, the empty platters came to rest in the center of the table as people leaned back in their chairs. No one got up to put away leftovers. We didn't worry then about botulism or the dreaded salmonella. The stories took on a full head of steam. We were small people, but we were big talkers, and the best talker of all was my father. He was mercurial. If you wanted to rise up over the arc of his narrative, you had to throw in something big and surprising. And not only did it have to be inventive, but it had to be relevant, because the members of my family could be brutal. If you added something that didn't contribute to the momentum of the story, someone was likely to turn to you and say, "And your point would be?" Or, "And you're telling us this because?" Some of my father's liveliest stories centered on my early attempts at driving, which usually ended with someone coming to my rescue. My father or brother running home to get the front-end loader or a bigger tractor to pull me out of the ditch or the muddy place where I'd gotten the tractor stuck. One too tight turn on the way home with the loaded trailer, and the whole pyramid of bales toppled into the ditch. But no matter how bad my driving got, my father never tired of throwing the keys in my direction. Fetching is a thing you do a lot of on the farm. The word fetch derives from the Middle English word fechen and an Anglo-Saxon word fecken, F-E-C-C-A-N, meaning to bring. Despite its archaic sound, it's a well-used term on a farm. One summer when I was a teenager, it was my job to fetch the milk cows each afternoon from the adjacent pasture where they'd been grazing all day. At 4:30, I was to get into the pickup and drive the half mile to the pasture. I didn't mind this chore. It gave me a chance to sneak an afternoon cigarette in an otherwise smokeless household. Once I reached the pasture, I would untie the long wire gate and pull it clear to the side, then drive into the pasture and circle the herd. As soon as I honked the horn, the cows would begin to move toward the open gate, already feeling the heaviness in their udders. They ambled along, following an old animal trail that had probably been there before the pasture and the fence, before me and the pickup had ever made an appearance on this land. I idled behind them as they made their slow way. I lit a cigarette and sucked in the swirling smoke, feeling the satisfying nicotine expand into my lungs. I listened to the radio and sang Inagada da Vida at the top of my lungs. Was it some new scent, some passing distraction, that caused about 15 of the cows to fork off one day, to turn down an intersecting road and move slowly in another direction away from the farm? This made me mad. I honked the horn and yelled, "Hey! Hey! Hey!" I pounded on the roof of the pickup to draw them back to the herd, but they continued to move away. I got out of the pickup, leaving it running in the middle of the intersection. I picked up some gravel and ran down the road, throwing rocks and cursing at them. And just as they began to turn around and make their way back, I heard a loud noise behind me, the metal kerchunk of bumper meeting grass, meeting fence post. When I turned to look, I saw the pickup had already come to rest. The front end was lodged impossibly against the corner post, and the back end was dug into the soft shoulder of the ditch. Underneath the pickup's jammed frame, from where I stood, I could see the deep curve of the ditch. I knew that backing it out was not an option for me. Then I did what any farm kid does in this situation. I swore first, then I began to run home fast. As I was running, I looked up the road to the house and saw my brother and father already coming out of the front door with keys in hand for the tractor that would pull me out of the ditch. After the dust of that day settled, this would be a story my father told again and again. He told it to Grandma and Grandpa. He told it to friends I brought home from school, to boyfriends I brought home from college. He said he'd been watching me that day through the binoculars, and he'd actually seen the pickup roll in the ditch behind my unsuspecting back. He had watched the horror dawn on my face as I turned to discover the pickup in the ditch, and he had observed my anguish as I took off running toward the farm. According to him, I had run so fast that day that I passed the milk cows, the older ones, the pregnant ones, the younger ones. I made my way through the ranks, even lapping our German Shepherd collie mix, Tippy, who had been racing down the road, wild-tongued, beside me. Eventually, he said, the only thing in front of me was a rabbit that had been flushed from the ditch. It was running scared in long, scalloping lopes, but when I came upon it, I kicked it in the ass and said, "Get out of the way and let somebody run who knows how to run." That's how fast I was going. What could I do but suffer through this story time and time again? For my father chose to leave out the one incriminating detail, the burning cigarette that he and Nick most certainly must have found smoldering in the ashtray when they pulled the pickup out. But he never mentioned the cigarette because that would have ruined the story. Then it would have become a cigarette in the ashtray story, rather than another good story about the time Debbie drove a vehicle in the ditch. Maybe he knew that withholding the most tender secret in a story makes the telling all the more delicious. There at that supper table, I learned to listen. As the youngest child, I was at play in a field that everyone around me had long ago mastered. But listeners have their place in stories, as do laughers, a job my grandmother took on. Without listeners and laughers, stories have nowhere to live. They float away and are forgotten. Sometimes it's hard to pin down a family story. They shift before you like mirages. A few years ago, my mother told me about the day my brother Nick came home from school. He was maybe 10. And as soon as he stepped off the bus, he took his Tonka truck to the garage and smashed it flat as a hubcap with a hammer. What had warranted such violent behavior? My mother still sometimes wondered. I filed this away and asked my brother the next time I saw him. "What was the deal with the Tonka truck?" I asked. "What made you so mad?" "I didn't do that," Nick said. "Jane did that." Interesting strategy, I thought. Blame it on the sister. Some time passed before I remembered to tell my mother what I had learned. "Nick says he didn't smash the Tonka truck," I told my mother. "He says Jane did it." I waited for my mom's definitive reply. "What Tonka truck?" my mother said with a perplexed look. By then, she had forgotten the entire episode. So you have to keep an eye on family stories, lest they fall through the crack between the two worlds. Here's one thing I remember for certain. I only saw my father cry once. It was the morning my brother left home the first time. He was 18 and had just graduated from high school. They had been arguing that morning in the barn while doing chores. I remember waking to the sound of loud voices, followed by the rumble of my brother's hot rod muffler and his tires throwing gravel as he peeled out of the yard. My first thought was that there had been some terrible accident. I threw on my shoes and ran out to the yard in my pajamas. All was silent, except for the rhythmic suction of the milking machines coming from the barn. I crossed the yard and approached the barn slowly. Through the open door, I saw the rows of cows swishing their tails. When I got closer, I peered inside the door, afraid of finding spattered blood, some evidence of a disaster. But I saw only my father. He was leaning against the support post, weeping, his face covered with his hands. A few years later, as a teenager, when I was feeling my wildest oats, I decided to run away from home myself. My three older sisters were long gone, and my brother hadn't yet been summoned home from his adventures. I had argued with my father that afternoon about a wrestling match going on in town. I wanted a ride, but he needed me to stay at home and help with chores. I remember stomping across the yard and throwing on a red barn coat for the 3-mile walk to town. It wasn't my coat, and red wasn't a color I often wore, but I remember the episode so vividly because of the red coat, and because of the way I imagined my father's eyes would follow me, a defiant crimson mark on the flat horizon, making small progress away from him, then disappearing as the road curved by the wildwoods and dipped into town. I stayed at a friend's house that evening and bummed a ride home in the morning. My father greeted me in the yard on his way to the barn for chores. "So you're back," he chuckled, and handed me a bucket as my friend's car circled our drive and roared away down the gravel road. "You can start by feeding the chickens." Sure, it would have been nice if he'd rejoiced, called the neighbors over, and killed a fatted calf upon my return. But I'd only been gone for 12 hours, and I hadn't yet wasted my substance with riotous living, as the parable requires. Besides, fatted calves were reserved for prodigal sons. Even I knew that. At the very least, I thought, he'd gotten the message. I wouldn't be hanging around this dust hole forever. Chapter 5. The Horizontal Life. On the flat horizon of a Midwestern town, the grain elevator props up the whole sky. It holds down the earth. The grain that sleeps fat and finished inside the elevator comes from sunshine and soil. It brings together heaven and earth. The railroad tracks that pass by the elevator crisscross the country. They sew together the land in great, long stitches, connecting the people in the small towns to larger cities and the grain to shipping ports. The day the grain elevator burned down in my hometown, the people gathered to watch it smolder and explode in blue billows and flames. "What catastrophe," they murmured. All those connections were reduced to ashes. The town felt cut off from the rest of the world. As the blaze gained strength, the volunteer firemen trained their hoses on the hottest parts of the spire and circled the elevator. They would not be made to do anything heroic, even though it was their own carefully cultivated grain surrendering itself to the flames. Perhaps it was a spark, some friction in the dust, or a carelessly discarded cigarette that started the elevator burning, but now it was the very substance of the grain that sustained the original spark, still to be found somewhere in the larger context of the blaze, growing from yellow to orange to red, roaring up and crackling in a way that the tiny spark couldn't have imagined. She would never have lost her virginity, the girl that I was, if the grain elevator had not burned down. She was not your stitch-in-time-saves-nine kind, nor your roll-the-extra-string-into-a-ball-and-save-it type of young woman that fiction writers who write stories about Midwestern girls like to create. If you had to classify her, you would say that she was a spender, that she was all thin limbs and long hair, that she was 14 years old, and that she had that walk down cold, the walk of someone who does not believe in life after 20. Not that she was saving her virginity for anything special. In fact, she saw it as a filmy substance, a dying skin that needed to be cast off. At that moment, fire appeared as rescuer, as change agent. How intensely it burns, and how little it leaves, the girl that I was thought, while watching the grain elevator burn down. It reminded her of the cigarettes her busy sister lit and left unsmoked in the ashtray, the thin column of ashes burning clean down to the filter. Already, she has an eye for metaphor that will only cause her problems. This habit of drawing equations between unlikely objects, an ability that will serve her so well later in life, only meets with raised eyebrows and shakes of the head in this small town. The grain elevator burning down will prove to be a symbolic event in her life, not that the girl that I was would have perceived it as such, since she had never heard of symbols and will not hear about symbolism for a good many years, long after she had ceased to be herself and was well on her way to becoming someone else who would, by some strange twist of fate, become me. At this point in her life, she's working on more basic concepts. Small things, like trying to get people to call her Deb instead of the more childish Debbie, and trying to find someone to lose her virginity to. By the time we see her here, she has experienced a number of things. She's tried French kissing and seen plenty of window fog. She's had her breasts nibbled, studied, and stroked. She's explored an endless variety of back seats, quietly undoing snaps and zippers and tricky belt buckles, slipping her hand deep into the moist pants of a local boy. The horizontal life has not completely eluded her. But she has impossible standards. She does not want the tentative touch of a novice, nor does she want a clumsy farm boy. No one who wears tidewater plaid pants smells of cow manure and lusts more for her father's full 6 quarters of land than for her own strong, slim, and tanned body. She's no longer interested in shy exploration or wonderment or handing her carefully pruned virginity over to a husband on a wedding night. She has an itch somewhere deep inside her, in a place she cannot even begin to direct someone to. But she doesn't want it scratched. She wants it vanquished. It will take an expert, someone who is as efficient as he is kind. She's looking for a wolf with a nice demeanor. But whoever this guy is, if he ever lived in this town, has certainly moved away. So, discontented, this girl that I was gathers with the rest of the people of her town, lined along the railroad tracks, and watches the grain elevator flare with fire and disappear in a dark plume of smoke. Fire loves me. In my youth, it so marked me as its own. fire in my head, like exploding stars, my first memory. 3 years old, a ring of fire burning in my vision. First, it broke through the curtain of my sight, a grove of chokecherry trees, a field of alfalfa bales, white sheets flapping on the line, my father's hand grasping a milk bucket. All that I saw solid before me, dissolving into fragments. It began with flashing shimmers of light in the shape of a V in the center of my vision. Then it grew over the next hour, adding more shimmering Vs around the periphery of my eyesight. Within moments, the shimmering Vs joined into a circle and spread, dissolving my vision into a blind wash of light. The world around me became slashes of light, reflecting back to me in fragments, like the shards of a broken mirror. The first time it happened, I was in the backyard, helping my sister Elizabeth feed the chickens. We were slinging oats from a sack in wide arcs onto the ground. We were like the sower in the Van Gogh painting, with the orange disk of the sun pelting golden droplets of sunlight on us as we pelted the earth with golden droplets of oats. The chickens rushed at us in excitement, so plump and so white. Their wild feet clawed the ground as they ran, 200 clucking white chickens running at us in the bright sunshine. And that's when the V of shimmering light broke through my vision for the first time. I tried to breathe. The green of the fresh-cut grass felt ripe in my throat. The sun glared in my eyes. Even in the cool morning air, I grew feverish, sweaty. I bent over to escape the light, but when I closed my eyes, I still saw it, the explosion shimmering in my head. Something inside my stomach felt too large. Something had to come up. My sister held me from behind so that I wouldn't throw up on my clothes. I was the youngest. She was the second oldest. If I made a mess, she would have to clean me up. She knew how I hated water, how I kicked and screamed under the sink on Saturday nights when she and my oldest sister tried to wash my hair for church the next morning. So my sister Elizabeth held my hair out of my face as I got sick, the fire in my head blazing for the first time. I had problems swallowing as a child, and breathing sometimes, too. At a nervous moment, I'd convince myself that I would never swallow again. Saliva would gather in my mouth. "Oh, no," I'd say to myself. "I'll have to go through life spitting and spitting." Then I would get distracted and swallow naturally, and the crisis would be over until the next time. And there were breathing problems. I could never get a deep breath. I'd yawn, pop my ears, panic for air, gulp and gulp and gulp, until my sisters would turn and complain, "Dad, she's doing it again." Then my dad would bend down, get his red face right next to mine, and scream, "Now you just relax," which always resulted in a deep intake of breath. And this is the place we're going to leave today, our reading of The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. Deborah Marquardt is a professor of English and coordinator of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. You've been listening to KHOI's Community Bookshelf, which you can hear every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. Producer is Mary Richards, Chief Engineer Rick Morrison, Program Engineer Ron Latson, and Assistant Producer Janet Kloss. For prior episodes, look at the bookshelf page on the KHOI website. Give us feedback at khoiradio@gmail.com. Thanks very much for listening.